When we first glimpsed James Bond in the latest novel in the series that Ian Fleming created in 1953, 007 is stopping a speeding Serbian train loaded with hazardous chemicals with his bare hands. Most of his tricky gadgets, though, have been installed as apps on his iPhone. He's driving a souped-up Jetta, not an Aston Martin, but he's sworn to protect the realm by any means necessary. Carte Blanche is the newest James Bond novel, authorized by the Ian Fleming estate, and this time they have entrusted an American to tell the story of what may be the most famous British character since Robin Hood. He's Jeffrey Deaver, the international best-selling author of 27 suspense novels, including The Bone Collector and The Bodies Left Behind. Jeffrey Deaver joins us in our studios. Thanks so much for being with us.
Well, hello, Scott. A big pleasure to be here.
Was it especially tricky to be an American asked to write a James Bond novel?
That is one of the first things that jumped into my mind when I was asked by the Fleming estate. The way I approach writing fiction, and part of the fun of writing fiction, is for me to step into the shoes of whatever character I'm writing about. For instance, in a book a few years ago called The 12th Card, I had to, quote, become a 16-year-old African-American girl living in Harlem, and I had to really inhabit her persona. It frankly was easier for me to become Bond for Carte Blanche because I began reading the books when I was 8 years old, and I had to, of course, pull certain things out of the original material to insert into the updated Bond story, Carte Blanche. Otherwise, the Bond fans would have been rather upset about it. And so when they asked me, I didn't have a huge transition to make to become the secret agent and write about him, I think, fairly credibly.
Let's talk about some of those elements. And let's begin with the villain you have here. Height, is that how
I pronounce
the name?
Yes, exactly.
A man with long, yellowing Howard Hughes fingernails. He craves decay.
We fiction authors, we love creating the bad guys. There's nothing like a good villain. And with Height, I wanted to create an individual who was what I typically do with a villain. They're fully formed. They certainly are despicable. That's what makes them villains. And yet there's got to be something rather intriguing about them. Height, for instance, is not a typical megalomaniac. I made Height concerned about the environment. His thing is recycling. Yeah. And I tried to bring some psychological depth to this character so that when Bond goes up against him, I want the readers to think, I sure hope Height doesn't succeed. But on the other hand, I kind of feel for him in a way, because this is something that's very important to him, this nefarious Incident 20, which I call it.
Well, explain briefly. A clock is ticking, and some incident's going to occur. British intelligence has found out about it. Thousands of lives might be at stake.
And we see from each main character's perspective, something terrible is going to happen, but we both have an important stake in the outcome.
Mm. Let's talk about the love interests, okay? I'm going to rattle them off. There is the sultry South African policewoman, Bika Jordan.
Becca
Jordan. Mm-hmm. The sultry South African anti-hunger activist of means, Felicity Willing.
I couldn't resist. I'm sorry.
And then the russet-haired, sultry has to be mentioned again, British special ops agent, Ophelia Maidenstone.
Yes.
And one is struck by the fact that James Bond, how do I phrase this nicely? It doesn't say no, but he does say not yet.
Yes.
It's not right.
Part of my job is to, well, frankly, tugging at the heartstrings. And Bond and Philly are...
Philly Maidenstone.
Philly
her,
Maidenstone.
Her nickname.
Yes. They're in a restaurant. Now, they're both single. She has recently broken up with her fiancé.
Removed her ring.
Yes. And she mentions casually that her flat is over the road in London, meaning very nearby. Would they like to retire there for an after-dinner cocktail? And Bond, of course, is thinking, well, I can sort of see where this is going. And what a nice connection it would be, because he feels something for her of substance. And then he looks down, and she is rubbing absently her ring finger where the engagement ring had been. And Bond thinks to himself, now is not the time. And I've had a very, very good response from readers about that scene. It gave him some heart and yet gave some hope to the readers that perhaps he will find somebody.
The story ranges from London to Dubai to Cape Town, from Cote de Bon wine to grilled halibut on the bone with hollandaise. How much research did you do, and was it all tax deductible as a professional expense?
If any, first of all, it's important to travel to every place you write about, and so I wanted to get all those details right, and I forced myself to even create a cocktail of my own that appears in the book, and that is now being served at the Savoy Hotel in London, under the name Carte Blanche.
Well, look, I was not going to spring this on you. I tried one last night. This is my receipt. Can I get you to sign it for the IRS?
I would be.
Because I believe this is a professional expense.
Scott, it's your name. It is. I won't say anything. I would have made one for you for half the price. But I'm delighted to sign it.
Well, I don't want to give away anything, but it's Crown Royal.
Yes.
Triple sec.
Yeah. Little bitters. Angostura bitters.
Little bitters.
Yeah.
The bartender said, you should not mix rye and triple sec.
I did have a headache the next day. There was that little issue, but I can see the way you had a little bit of an issue, too.
I think I still do. With a more serious note, M observes to Bond at one point that he wonders if the world's great intelligence agencies are quite keeping pace with modern threats, specifically international terrorism.
When I write one of my thrillers, yes, they're sick and twisted and fast-paced roller coasters, but if you don't give some resonance, some perhaps political or philosophical or social or personal resonance, readers are going to think, oh, it's a bit of a cartoon, and they will not be emotionally engaged. The title itself, Carte Blanche, is a theme that runs throughout the book. Bond is someone who operates outside the bounds of the law, and he continually asks himself, at what point in exercising that do I become them? Do I become the enemy? And it's a question we certainly have wrestled with here in America. Look at Guantanamo, for instance. And I don't give any answers to that. But I want readers to think, you know, that is something about Bond that I never really questioned before.
What drives James Bond?
It sounds like such a cliche. It's right versus wrong. Who is James Bond? James Bond is a knight. He may have a flawed personal life, but someone like that who is willing to sacrifice himself, I think we can allow a little indulgence to. But when it came to his mission, he was going to do whatever he needed. And I have to say he does it with a flair, with some panache, with a wry British humor. And it's the package that has made Bond a creation that will endure for a long, long time.
Best-selling suspense writer Jeffrey Deaver. He has written the latest 007 novel, Carte Blanche. Mr. Deaver, what a pleasure. Thanks so much.
Scott, I appreciate it.
June 16th is Bloomsday, the annual celebration of the life and work of James Joyce and the events of the day he depicts in his novel Ulysses. Frank Delaney will celebrate, of course, but then just about every day is Bloomsday for him. On Bloomsday last year, Frank began an ambitious project. He's deconstructing Joyce's Ulysses one chapter at a time for a weekly podcast called Rejoice.
That opacity connects the Übermensch to Adam, because when Nietzsche had Zarathustra thus spake of the Übermensch, he claimed that when the Übermensch took his rightful place in the future, and there would be no more man, no more ordinary man, the last man standing would therefore be the most reviled thing on earth.
Got it? By Bloomsday this year, Frank Delaney will have completed Chapter 1, just 17 to go, and there have been more than 100,000 downloads. Frank Delaney joins us from our studios in New York. Frank, so wonderful to have you back. Thanks very much.
Hello, Scott.
How long is this going to take?
Well, I did think when I started it was going to take around 20 to 22 years. But given the Chapter 1, which is one of the shortest and simpler chapters in the book, it has taken exactly 1 year. I've revised my estimates upward, and I'm looking at around 28 to 30 years.
Frank, will there be downloads in 28 to 30 years?
Well, there will be on the cloud somewhere. Yeah. I've got to make sure that I'm not on the same cloud.
Of course, your 1981 book, James Joyce's Odyssey, is considered a classic by a number of us. Why did you decide to undertake this process now?
Here's the thing, Scott. You know, I am a passionate believer in democratization. I couldn't bear, when I was in my 20s, that a fellow countryman of mine had written a book that I couldn't understand. Not only could I not understand it, but a whole cadre of people across the world seemed to have a vested interest in making sure that nobody understood it, because, of course, he entitled literary snobbery in a way that had never been done before. The snobbery around Joyce congealed. We couldn't break through it at all, so I thought, this isn't good enough. I tried three times to read it. I failed every single time. I stumbled and sprawled across the doorstep of Ineluctable Modality of the Visible in Chapter 3. Never got further. And then I made the breakthrough. I thought, if I'm to understand this book, I can't just read it. I must write a book about it, and then I'll have to understand it. What happened thereafter? Call it falling in love.
Rejoice was once a one-man show. Now there's the podcast. here's another form of modern media you've taken on to tell the story.
He wasn't born into a house of artistry and intellect. His father was a bombast who found it hard to get respect. Yet Jim, from the time he went to school and then to college, astounded all around him by the way he soaked up knowledge. These are well-known facts about his brain, his great capacity. But the fact is, he's remembered chiefly for his great opacity.
Not exactly Little Wayne, but it makes the point, doesn't it?
Well, it's the Rejoice rap in which all the great rappers of our time meet Monty Python, introduced by Gilbert and Sullivan. I think that's the best way I can summarize it. It's part of a device, Scott, to break through the idea that this man is impossible to understand.
Frank, give us a line that means something to you that we can take to Bloomsday.
Oh, my God. I brought the book with me. I have an early copy here. Yeah. I have the 1928 edition. I've just opened it on page 24, and it's Stephen teaching in a school at the edge of Dublin. And here's an idea of what I'm doing, Scott. In the middle of asking a boy a question about King Pyrrhus, Pyrrhic victory, a man who won all his battles but lost so many men in the process that it was more costly to win than to lose, while Stephen Dedalus, one of the protagonists, who is the autobiographical Joyce, is actually teaching, his mind wanders. And he says, "Fabled by the daughters of memory, and yet it was in some way, if not as memory fabled it, a phrase then of impatience, thud of Blake's wings of excess. I hear the ruin of all space, shattered glass and toppling masonry, and time one livid final flame, what's left us then?" Now, what's in there is half a dozen references to that wonderful 17th, 18th century visionary and poet, mm-hmm. William Blake, who wrote the words for Jerusalem. What was Blake's great remark? "The road of excess leads to the palace of wisdom." That's in there. No bird ever flew too high who flew in his own wings. That's in there. Blake's apocalyptic vision of the end of the world. That's in there. So when I come to a phrase like this, and I'm working out the week's podcast, which is only 5 or 7 minutes, the excitement of unwrapping all these references is something unrivaled in my life. And at the same time, it takes me away from my ordinary world, and it's kind of like a little private university to which one goes and in which one receives a diploma every single day.
Frank, thanks so much.
Scott, thank you very much. Happy Bloomsday.
And happy Bloomsday to you, my friend. Frank Laney, author and Joyce scholar. Despite himself sometimes, his podcast, Rejoice, is available on his website, frankdelaney.com, and on iTunes. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. The current economy with a high unemployment rate is among the reasons more Americans seem to be asking, is a college degree really worth it? Mike Rose is a professor of education at UCLA. He's spent a career thinking about the value of a college education. He joins us from the studios of NPR West. Thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, thank you, Scott.
So, recognizing the answer might be complicated, why should students and their families go into hock for hundreds of thousands of dollars to get a job that might pay less than what they paid for tuition?
Well, you know, I think maybe the place to start is with the hundreds of thousands of dollars part. You know, it's unfortunate that we set our sights on the top 20, 30 universities in the United States when we think about going to college. And by top, I mean the ones that get the highest rankings in U.S. News and World Report, the ones that have the most cachet. But there are thousands upon thousands of other institutions of higher learning, public institutions of higher learning, where it costs a whole lot less and where you can get a decent education. And unfortunately, I think people are kind of guided away from them because they're quote-unquote low status. They're not going to lead anywhere, but it's just not true.
There are undoubtedly benefits other than vocational to a college education, but I'm wondering if it's harder in a time like this to get people to focus on that.
I mean, you know, we respond to the threat that's most imminent, right? I mean, that's the way we survive. It's part of human nature. So it makes complete sense that when we listen to public policy spokespeople, when we listen to our legislators, that virtually the only reason we hear to get an education is an economic one. You know, we need to prepare students for the 21st century economy, and we need to educate our citizenry so that we can regain the kind of economic preeminence that we held for so long. All of that is understandable. What concerns me, Scott, is that it can also narrow our vision. If all we talk about, as we've been doing for decades now, is the economic payoff of education, that ends up affecting finally what we teach and how we teach it. Mm. It ends up affecting the way we define what it means to be educated.
Well, and remind us of some of those benefits.
You know, historically, there's been many other justifications for education in our country that, in fact, have trumped the economic one. I mean, for many, many years, the civic and moral purpose of mass education was trumpeted. Mm-hmm. You know, the Jeffersonian ideal, right? That to have a functioning democracy, you need an educated citizenry. So that kind of civic purpose of education has certainly been important. The idea of intellectual growth, that is, not just learning things to make a living, but also learning things to enable you to do things with your life, to enable you to find interests and pursuits that in some way or another maybe, you know, expand the way you see things. There's a social benefit to it, for sure. Learning to think together, learning to attack problems together, learning how to disagree, being exposed to other points of view. So there's these kind of multiple reasons that historically have played in and out of our justifications for schooling.
Is it harder, though, to get people to cherish the value of the Jeffersonian ideal when they're working as a barista?
That's a really good point. But maybe that's exactly the time when they should be thinking about the Jeffersonian ideal. That is, the kind of education that would enable you to think about the politics and economics that have you working in a Starbucks. You know, to be able to think about our economic situation in some kind of a analytical and sophisticated way is not something that comes easy, and I think it does come with study.
What's the effect of students being able to look at people like Bill Gates and Jeff Zuckerberg and Steve Jobs? And they're pretty prominent college dropouts who will say college was just not meeting my needs. And they can finish that sentence by saying, and now I'm one of the most successful people in the world.
I am absolutely not a person who says one size fits all. In arguing for some kind of education beyond high school, I'm not just talking about the regular four-year liberal arts degree. I mean, I think a lot of remarkable stuff happens in occupational programs, in two-year college programs. You know, the Bill Gateses, the Zuckerbergs. They're rare, and I think we have to be careful about generalizing from rare examples.
Is college still valuable for giving students a space to experiment?
Some of the students I work with in a poor urban community college right now, boy, they don't have time to experiment, right? I mean, they are desperately trying to build the skills to be able to get a better toehold on the economy. So let's first admit that the good fortune to be able to experiment isn't available to everybody just in terms of, you know, your income background. But that notion of college as being a place to try things on makes a lot of sense to me. I mean, I see it so often. Young people come in, they have an idea for a major, and then they take that astronomy class, or they take that history class, or they take that literature class, or a dance class, and boom, a light goes on for them, and they find a passion.
Mike Rose, a professor of education at UCLA, author of several books about education, including The Mind at Work. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Scott.
You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Time for sports. Give her that old joke. I went to a fight the other night and a hockey game broke out. Well, might not be so far from the truth in the Stanley Cup Series between Vancouver and Boston. These two teams don't seem to like each other. Also true in the NBA Finals, NPR's Tom Goldman joins us to talk some trash talk. Morning, Tom.
I'm not taking the bait. Good morning, Scott. You're sounding wonderful today.
And Tom, I think you sound lucid and gracious, as always, typically, my friend. All right, let's get to this. Roberto Luongo, the great Vancouver goalie, ordinarily woke up last night after getting shelled by the Bruins, I guess, two previous games.
Yeah.
So, I mean, what did he just open his eyes?
Well, he played Vancouver took advantage of that old magic elixir of home ice. Mm-hmm. The home team has won every game in this series. Now, if Game 5 last night had been in Boston instead of Vancouver, it probably would have been tough for the Canucks to turn the momentum. As you say, they got shelled in Games 3 and 4. But, as you said, Luongo came through. He's been brilliant and streaky in goal. He's been mm-hmm. benched twice in the playoffs for shoddy play, including during this series. But he put on his brilliant mask last night. He stopped 31 shots. The Canucks matched the Bruins' toughness and scored a wonderful third period goal. And now Vancouver is one win away from winning its first Stanley Cup.
As are the Dallas Mavericks in the NBA Finals. They can win it on the road in Miami.
Well, not the Stanley Cup.
Sorry. All right. The NBA champ. No, they are that good. Okay. The Mavericks okay. are that good. They're going to win it in both
true.
Sports.
True. Very true.
Now, the Mavs aging center, Dirk Nowitzki, has played magnificently in the clutch. And the other night, despite a 101-degree fever. But yesterday, Dwayne Wade and LeBron James, will have some fun with his nickname, had some fun at Dirk's expense.
Oh, did y'all hear me call? I think I'm sick.
What is LeBron James doing making jokes about a great player?
Okay, Scott, if you'll indulge me, I would like to rant about this, and I'll answer your question through this
Remember,
rant.
Remember, I'm a spiritual Clevelander. Go ahead, my friend.
There's so many things wrong with this. Them making fun of Dirk Nowitzki being sick, it's childish. It's arrogant. They knew the cameras were rolling, and they still did it. And as you say, it is startling with LeBron. He's mocking Dirk Nowitzki. He should be watching Dirk on video and learning how to dominate the end of games instead of scoring 11 total points in the fourth quarters of the five games. Now, after the video, I think a lot of us are feeling less charitable about LeBron. And we've seen enough evidence this past week to say, okay, he is shrinking in the fourth quarters. He's not up to the challenge of the finals. Please go ahead and prove this wrong, LeBron. Prove that you are the so-called best player on the planet. But until you do, I am much more interested in all the players in this great series who aren't brands, who haven't tattooed themselves with slogans like Chosen One, but who play great, exciting basketball, and who perform wonderfully in the clutch. Thank you, Scott, and God bless America.
Do you want to take another 30 seconds on that line? I think that's – so what's your favorite joke of the week? All right. I stopped LeBron James on the street and said, excuse me, sir, it's an honor to meet you. Do you have change of a dollar? And do you know what he said?
What?
He said, well, here are three quarters, but I have no fourth quarter.
Ba-boom.
Well, all right. You think they can close it out, the Mavs?
I think they can. They have to do it in Game 6, though, because if Miami wins Game 6 on their home court in Game 7, maybe a tall order for Dallas. But we're all rooting for Dallas.
NPR's Tom Goldman, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
From NPR News, this is Weekends on All Things Considered. Guy Raz is away. I'm Rachel Martin. We're following the unrest in the Middle East this hour, and we'll bring you the latest from the Turkey-Syria border as refugees try to escape a crackdown by the Syrian regime. But we begin tonight with news of a break-in with global repercussions. The New York Times is reporting that the International Monetary Fund has been hacked, a victim of what officials quoted in the Times are calling a sophisticated and serious cyber attack. It's just the latest in a string of high-profile hack jobs. This week, Spanish officials made three arrests in an attack on Sony that revealed the personal information of 77 million account holders. And Citigroup revealed that it, too, had been hacked and that 200,000 credit card holders were affected. That's our cover story today. Hackers aiming high. What are they after? What's the government doing about it? And could Apple's new iCloud be next? Last year, at a convention in New York City, a group of computer hackers gathered in a hotel ballroom for a panel discussion called...
This talk is called Informants, Villains, or Heroes.
Informants, the hackers knew, were becoming a bigger and bigger problem in their community. These were hackers who'd cooperate with the government, rat out other hackers, in exchange for reduced punishment for their own crimes.
And we all have stories in our lives as to how informants have played a part one way or another.
And the consensus was things were getting pretty serious.
Okay. Not
well,
I.
The thing is, in the hacker world, the odds are, what is it, 1 in 4, 1 in 5? It's a ridiculous percentage, but the number of people who become informants...
That's the panel moderator, Emmanuel Goldstein, estimating to an audience of hackers that 1 in 4 of them is an informant, usually working with the FBI.
And the question that I think we need to ask here today is, why do people do this? Why does this happen?
Also sitting on this panel was Adrian Lamo. He's probably the most well-known informant of this century, an ex-hacker who turned in Bradley Manning. That's the U.S. soldier who released the WikiLeaks documents. Lamo was treated like a turncoat.
And what you did is worse than treason. I think you belong in Guantanamo.
Whoa.
Okay. Thank you.
If you didn't get that, he says, I think you belong in Guantanamo. Things were tense in this room. And outside the panel, what's the atmosphere in the larger hacker community?
The overriding one is a sense of paranoia and fear.
Ed Pilkington covers hacking for the Guardian newspaper.
Because they don't really know who's doing what. It seems such an extraordinary contradiction. Here is this community, which, you know, in popular sort of vision, is a community of anarchists, of anti-establishment people. And yet here are so many of them actually acting as the eyes and ears, as virtual spies on behalf of the FBI and the Secret Service.
But still, 1 in 4 hackers is an FBI informant? That number seemed high to us.
I believe the number is much higher. I don't know of any case that involved computer hacking where there was multiple defendants charged, where there wasn't an informant on the case.
That is Kevin Mitnick.
I live in Las Vegas, Nevada, and I'm an information security consultant, and I have an interesting history. So.
As a kid, Mitnick found he had a knack for what was then called phone freaking, essentially hacking phones before there were computers.
When I got pretty adept with manipulating the phone company's systems, I was able to pull pranks. Like, I remember one where I was able to change a friend's home telephone, change their class of service to that of a payphone, so whenever he or his parents would pick up the phone to make a call, it would say...
The call you have made requires a 25-cent deposit.
You know, so I do these, like, crazy things. I figured out how to intercept directory assistance for Providence, Rhode Island. So, you know, I'd say, what city? They'd say, you know, Providence. And I'd say, can I have the name, please? And they'd give me the name. And I'd go, yeah, that number is, you know, 554-21537. They'd go, what? 554-21537. Well, how do I dial a half? Oh, you have to go get the new phone.
Fast forward a few years, Mitnick's not just hacking phones, he's breaking into phone companies to hack their computers. He began hacking into the systems of various computer companies just to show that he could. By 1995...
What ended up happening is I was arrested in February 1995.
A man described as the most wanted computer hacker in the world has been arrested in Raleigh, North Carolina.
Legend has it that Mitnick had been able to break into the highly secret computers at the North American Air Defense Command.
He's now being held on federal charges of computer fraud.
I was even held in solitary confinement for like a year because a federal prosecutor had told a judge that I could somehow pick up the phone, dial a computer at NORAD, and whistle into the phone somehow, connect to their computers, and launch a nuclear weapon.
So could you do that?
Let me practice. I mean, I have to get the tone perfectly. Of course not. I mean that's so ridiculous.
All told, Mitnick did 5 years in jail for wire fraud and computer fraud. His final undoing, a partner of his, another hacker, informed on him, gave Mitnick up for a lesser sentence.
You definitely feel a great sense of betrayal. I mean, if hackers or anyone committing a criminal act wants to reduce their risk, they obviously don't involve anybody else. So the greater the circle of people that know what you're doing, the higher the risk.
Today, the risk and the stakes have never been higher, as more and more personal and financial information has wound up on the web. Hackers have increasingly banded together to attack that information.
And before long, the FBI realized that they had a major problem here.
Again, Guardian reporter Ed Pilkington.
The main group are the carders. Now, they specialize in breaking into databases of credit cards, usually held by banks or credit card companies. They can do millions of dollars of damage in terms of stealing directly from bank accounts or going out with fraudulent credit cards that they create using this database of information.
They do this with very sophisticated attacks, but the FBI has managed to fight them, Pilkington says, using an old-fashioned trick.
It's the trick they use against drug gangs. It's a trick that they use against mobsters and the mafia. You catch a little guy doing a little thing. I'll give you an example. There's this guy called Albert Gonzalez. He was caught fraudulently catching money out of an ATM, which, you know, in the scheme of this stuff, is pretty small beer.
Mm-hmm.
They sprung him from prison, got him a deal so that he was let out early. They then set him up within an FBI office. They paid him $75,000 a year to go out and set up networks, chat rooms, meeting other hackers. And he became essentially a honey trap for big carders and identity theft within the hacking community.
Thing is, that guy, Albert Gonzalez, last year he was given the longest ever prison sentence for hacking, 20 years, because while he was working as an informant for the FBI, he was secretly hacking government agencies and bank accounts. 15 years ago, Kevin Mitnick says things were not this complicated.
When I was a hacker, it was all about pursuit of knowledge, you know, getting a bite of the forbidden apple, so to speak. And then, of course, the challenge and the seduction of adventure. It's kind of like when you're a kid growing up and there's an old abandoned house down the street and you're not supposed to go over into that house.
Except I have to point out, those are 12-year-old boys and they're breaking into an abandoned house, and that's pretty benign. I mean, these are grown people breaking laws.
Right, but when I was hacking, maybe the analogy isn't perfect, but I'm trying to give you a sense of what my driving factor was when I was hacking. Today, it's all changed. Mm. I mean, the trend of hacking today is all profit. Credit card numbers, bank account numbers. For example, Sony recently has suffered, I think, over 17 attacks.
And there's another tech company hackers were probably watching very closely this past week.
So I get to talk about iCloud. We've been working on this for some time now.
That's Apple CEO Steve Jobs announcing iCloud, a new service that will allow Apple users to store all of their email, photos, music, and documents on one central server. That means you can access the photos on your phone from any computer.
By centralizing the data, they've really painted a target on their back.
David Brumley is a computer scientist at Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh. He says Apple's iCloud is actually a bank of servers in North Carolina in a building the size of 2 football fields.
From the reports, they have barbed wire around the building. They have guards, and you're going to need an ID to get into those buildings. And so the physical security is actually pretty good. It would be a lot like getting onto a military installation to actually get into Apple's iCloud data center. The common thing to do is to serve all this data from this location, but actually to have multiple backups. And so if there was a natural disaster, people may not be able to get at their files right away, but they'd still be somewhere. Apple could still restore them and make them available at a later time.
But so then, as a potential consumer here, as someone who's maybe thinking about putting my data on iCloud, I hear that and that seems like a red flag. Not only am I giving you all of my personal data, it's going to be backed up.
Yep, that's another avenue for attackers. It's also, of course, just a risk because nothing ever goes away. If you're ever in a lawsuit or something like that, of course, someone could subpoena that backup and get that data as well. So there's not just the attackers, there's also just the idea that it's around and someone can get at it.
Well, I mean, actually, I hacked into Apple when I was a hacker, and it wasn't too difficult.
We asked Kevin Mitnick if he could hack into the iCloud.
I mean, I was hired to test this cloud infrastructure in South America. Literally, in the 15 minutes I was on the phone with the CEO of the company and one of the lead technical guys, I was able to compromise and get access that only system administrators should be able to get access to. And then the next day I found a way that I could exploit that server to get full administrative access.
And when you do something like that, do you think to yourself, yeah, I still got it?
No, I do. I have to keep up with this stuff because I'm actually hired by companies to hack into their systems and networks. But anything out there is vulnerable to attack given enough time and resources.
Kevin Mitnick, he spoke to us from our bureau in Culver City. His memoir, Ghost in the Wires, will be published this August. Kevin, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
Few things could make a teenager squirm more than a parent. Probably vice versa, too. Parents can wear funny clothes and tell old, unfunny jokes. But Dale Price may have earned a gold plaque in the Goofy Dads Hall of Fame. When school bus routes were changed in American Fork, Utah this year, 16-year-old Rain Price realized the bus would go past his house every morning. And for 170 consecutive school mornings, his father, Dale, stood outside waving goodbye in a different goofy costume. Of course, Dad blogged about it, too, photos included. Dale Price joins us from the studios of member station KCPW in Salt Lake City. Thanks for being with us.
No, thanks for having me.
And what kind of costumes?
Anything you can think of. Painters, construction workers, prairie women, Batwoman, Wonder Woman. I had a lot of women in there. Sitting on
we'll review the possible psychology behind this later.
But with that many days, you got to be kind of creative and just kind of make things out of nothing.
I mean, did he hide on the floor of the school bus?
No. The very first day, in fact, my wife and I went out together. There was no costumes. We just both went out there. And I remember him kind of looking out the window, kind of hiding his eyes and thinking, you know, those aren't my parents. I don't know who they are.
Those aren't my parents inside my house.
No idea who that is. And then when he came home from school, he told my wife, he said, "Mom, please don't let Dad go out there again." And I heard that. And then it was a big surprise.
How long did it take to go from embarrassing to endearing?
About half of the school year, really. Cool. It wasn't the bad embarrassment where you don't want to face anybody. It was the good embarrassment where you're singled out for an award, you know, come up to the front of the class, that kind of thing. And he would still come home. We'd talk about it after school. And I'd always ask him, you know, "What'd you think of this one?" And, you know, sometimes it was, "Oh, that one was pretty neat. You know, I like that one." And then other days, "What about this one?" And he'd say, no, Dad, no.
And what would you like your son to take away from this once his blushing has receded?
I would like him to remember the experience. I know he's getting older. He's turning into his own young man. And really, as a father, I'm quickly heading for the sidelines in his life just to kind of become a spectator. And everything when you're a teenager is so stressed out and you're so worried about things. Hopefully these memories will last with him and he'll have some humor. You know, and just remember not to take things too seriously and enjoy life for what it is.
Okay, you convinced me.
You're going to go do it now.
I'm going to go do it for our daughters now. Well, Dale Price of American Fork, Utah. And by the way, what's your most embarrassing father moment? You can visit NPR.org to tell us your story, and we're going to share some of them next week. Thanks so much, Mr. Price.
Oh, that was fun. Thank you.
This is NPR News.